Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Gary Beach to the broadcast. Gary is the publisher emeritus for CIO Magazine, America's leading magazine and website for technology executives. Gary is also the author of the best-selling book, The U.S. Technology Skills Gap, What Every IT Exec Needs to Know to Save America's Future. In 1995, Gary founded TechCorps, a nonprofit and the nation's longest-standing group challenging IT workers to volunteer time to public schools. As spokesperson for CIO Magazine, he's appeared on CNBC's Squawk Box, Squawk on the Street, and Closing Bell programs addressing technology investment trends. From 1999 to 2002, he was a regular technology commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered and Morning Edition programs. Prior to joining CIO Magazine in 1997, Gary was publisher and president of two IDG publications, Computer World and Network World. He joined IDG in 1987 after a 10-year career in managerial posts at McGraw-Hill Incorporated. He's currently writing a book entitled The Educational Disarmament of America, Why Middle School Math and Science Teachers Hold the Key to America's Future. Gary has a Bachelor of Arts degree in Urban Affairs from Manhattan College. I recently caught up with Gary by phone in his Boston area office, and our conversation primarily focused on world-class IT principle one, people, as Gary spoke about the need for our country to focus on growing technology and STEM talent, the evolution of the CIO role, his thoughts about the future of technology in America, more generally speaking, as well as a variety of other topics. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Well, Gary Beach, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks, Peter. It's good to be here.
Excellent. Well, Gary, I wanted to begin with your terrific book, The U.S. Technology Skills Gap, What Every Technology Executive Must Know to Save America's Future. This is a poignant book and a well-timed book, as there are a lot of people, for very good reason, talking about the need for America to produce more technology talent in a variety of ways, to remain here in the U.S. and to keep us competitive. And I thought we'd begin with a diagnosis of the problem. Why is there, in your estimation, Gary, a technology skill gap in America to begin with?
I guess if I must, I would defer to a gentleman named Glenn Whitney, who kind of said it best when I was researching the book. Glenn is a former Wall Street guy who started the Museum of Mathematics in New York City last year. And his take on it, and I tend to agree, is that Americans have never been particularly good at math and science and tend to perceive these subjects as subjects that were done by dead Greek guys 1,000 years ago. And if you look at it, I'm certainly no John Steinbeck, but I think the strength of the book is the chronologic presentation of the content. So I literally start in 1909, just after some great inventions in Edison and the others. And there was a tremendous period of innovation in that second decade, nearly 100 years ago. But at the same time, there was a steep drop-off in high school among the percentage of kids who were taking math and science. And that kind of continued, through the 20s and 30s. And it was, by the time World War II came around, the Germans were tremendously ahead of us. And, one thing led to another. Of course, how the war ended. But after World War I, the baby boomers, the U.S. public education system was not prepared for 2 million additional kids for 15 straight years knocking on the doors of public schools. There weren't enough teachers, the schools were overcrowded, and to some extent, in a chapter in the book I call Boomerang, we're still feeling the impact of that 1950s through mid-60s education process in all subject areas here in America. And it's now being poignantly pointed out in these international studies that are the most prominent being the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They do a test called PISA, which stands for Program International Student Assessment, every 3 years on math and science and problem solving. And for a country that spends $800 billion a year in public education, American kids you should be better than 36th in math and 23rd in science. And it's not about creating a nation of brainiacs, if you will. You know, what I'm trying to point out in the book, unless we close this skills gap, our future economy is going to be weaker. And the employability of our workers, we might look at 7%, 6.5%, almost 7% unemployment. And that might be perceived as being good in 10 years. You know, there's 4 million open jobs and there's 11 million unemployed people. So, and the thing that worries me most, frankly, is I just finished reading a white paper written by some strategic military think tank down in D.C. And the title of the paper is called Blown to Bits. And it was a fictional story about the summer of 2020. And what happened in that time frame was the People's Republic of China launched a massive cyber attack on the United States. We have just not, as a nation, because there's so many cooks in the kitchen of public education, said this is a problem, we've got to fix it.
Can you get into some of the many recommendations that you have in the book to begin to turn this around?
Yeah, the number one issue is, in my mind, you can ask anybody who wants to play in tomorrow to say, hey, look, anybody raise their hands if they can remember the name of the best teacher they've ever had in their life, raise your hand. I mean, I've done this a million times in speeches to CIOs, and everybody raises their hand because there's no doubt about the impact of great teaching on learning. And this is not to say we don't have great teachers in America. We certainly do. But what's going to happen over the next 10 years, a lot of teachers are going to be retiring. And McKinsey went in and looked at this problem in terms of high-performing countries like Finland, South Korea, and Japan. And the premise going in was that those countries performed well because they have a much more homogeneous society, whereas in America, we are much more diverse. And they came out of it saying, that wasn't the reason these countries perform well. One of the major reasons these countries perform well is because they each have proactive national education strategies to only hire. To only hire, as elementary and high school teachers, kids who graduate in the top 20% of the college class. And you're 21st percent, can't do it. If you want to be an elementary teacher, K-5 in North Korea, you have to be in the top 5%. So it's great teaching. How else we turn it around is we need to start teaching math and science in an elementary kind of way at a much earlier age. Computer Associates, CA International, they underwrite a program on BS, Sesame Street, where Grover is portrayed as Super Grover. He's teaching 2 to 5 year olds some of the elements of science and math. So I don't want to get into a political discussion about early childhood education, but nonetheless, there is data that suggests that we should start early. And another thing that concerns me is in these global tests, they break out each nation's students into 6 different groupings. And group 6 is the highest group in terms of, you know, let's say the 95 percentile, so to speak. And America's percentage of group 6 students has dropped since 2000. And these are the kids that are going to be the inventors, the innovators. That's a big alarm bell. And we need to do, as you and I were mentioned, we were talking earlier about a trip I had to Cincinnati last week. And one of the biggest applause lines I got in speaking to these 500 or 600 14-year-old high school kids was we need to get rid of age-segregated education in America. And by that is, you know, no business, yours nor mine, you promote people by age. That's the way we do it in public education. What we need to do a much better job is by at least age 13, identify our superstars and accelerate their education process. So there's a lot of work to be done in this in terms of studying the IT industry. You know, one of my favorites, you know, we could have this debate about if the CMO, the CIO, and CSO, whatever's going to have all these budgets. You know, when it goes bad, and it always goes bad, you know, whose throat is going to get choked? And that's the problem in public education in America. There's not a throat to choke. Is it the unions? Is it the parents? Is it the politicians? Is it, in fact, I think kids have to become even more accountable for their own education.
Great points. I was intrigued by the story that you were sharing with me earlier and that you've mentioned here about the IT Olympics that you went to in Cincinnati. And I also think a little bit about the MOOCs that have emerged and even Khan Academy and some other education-based technology platforms that are geared towards Edmodo is another one geared towards K-12 as well, that have an emphasis on STEM subjects, in some cases among others, but oftentimes in some cases even a strict focus on the STEM subjects. Do you feel like there has been any shift or movement that gives you reason for optimism?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very impressed. I mean, the whole aspect of MOOCs, is, and most people think it's relatively new with Coursera, Udacity, edX. It goes back, you know, more than a decade before that, because I remember my daughter in high school when she was a junior, so that had to be like 1999 to year 2000. She participated in a Concord consortium up here in Massachusetts, and something called the Virtual High School. And it was kind of, you know, asynchronous, so to speak. She took a class, and her teacher was in Singapore. So this has been going on for a while. Certainly, it's a lot, you know, more robust now. And there's frankly a big debate, not so much the Khan Academy model, but, you know, the higher ed. You and I were talking about the great work they're doing at MIT and Harvard at edX. So, you know, let's focus on that as an example of where I'm coming from on being a big supporter of MOOCs. So at CES last month, you know, Dr. Agarwal from edX was speaking. And there's been some notables, mostly Mr. Gates, who kind of looks at MOOCs and says, okay, this is the grand scheme here was with free education to expand the scope of people who could take advantage of great professors at either Stanford or MIT or Harvard or wherever. And, you know, Gates will harp about, and rightfully so to some extent, I suspect, the abysmal completion rates of MOOCs. And Dr. Agarwal, in his first class, you know, they thought they're going to get 3,000 or 5,000 people, and they got 154,000. And, you know, I remember him saying at an MIT conference a year or so ago, he goes, oh my God, how am I going to answer all these questions from these kids, which he didn't have to do anyway, because all the community answered questions for the community. But what he said on stage that day a year ago or so was, he goes, the days were a piece of parchment that says you took the classes that I said you would take, and you got the grades that I accept as acceptable. And I think over time, we're going to see that. Now, getting back to the MOOC thing, of those 154,000 people, according to Dr. Agarwal, about 132,000 of them dropped out at the first problem set. A large portion dropped out. Then of, let's say, the 12 or 13,000 that remained, maybe, let's say, there's 14,000, 12,000 made it to the midterm. 10,000 passed the midterm. And then of those 10,000, again, these are broad numbers, nearly 8,000 completed the course. And some will look at that and say 7 or 8,000 over 154,000, to Bill Gates' point, so that's not a particularly good completion rate. But, you know, Dr. Agarwal will say, well, there's only 3,000 freshmen at MIT, and I have 7,000 people who took this class and passed it. So it's pretty exciting. And also the fact that, again, the folks that look at MOOCs and say they're not broadening the horizon will critique them because 66% of those 8,000 people who completed the course already had an undergraduate degree. And the way I look at it is 34% didn't. And that's a lot of people. The thing we need to do in business is convince hiring managers and human resource personnel that these certificates from MOOCs are very valuable. It's serious work. So I'm a big supporter of MOOCs. I think it's going to become a very viable, broad-based alternative to public education.
I can't talk to you, Gary, somebody with such a long history covering CIOs with CIO Magazine, among other places, and not talk to you about the sort of state of the CIO. You've been covering CIOs practically since the emergence of the title. And so I wonder, what are your thoughts now about the state of the CIO today?
There's a couple of things. When the magazine was started in 87, I was surprised to see that back then, in 87, one of the key topics that chief information officers were wrestling with was how to make the CIO more business savvy. And here we are, you know, 26, 27 years later, and that's also the focus. And what astounds me, absolutely astounds me, is our state of the CIO survey for the last 5 years has asked a question to 750 men and women who respond to the survey. And we give them five choices in terms of how is IT perceived at your company? Is it a cost center? Is it perceived as just a peer? Is it a colleague? A business game changer, so to speak. I'm astounded that the answer of business game changer has never broken more than 9%. Not 9%. So it really is. I mean, these men and women have incredibly difficult jobs. And, you know, they've kind of lived their lives over the last 25 years in terms of, okay, we can go back further to the modern age of IT starting around 1950, but okay, let's automate business processes, and they did that. Then let's make those automated business processes more reliable and dependable, and they did that. But now they're wrestling with, and with those two eras, they were able to focus singularly, if you will, Peter, on one tsunami, if you will. So in the 50s, it was the mainframe. In the mid-60s, it was the mini, the PC in 1980, e-commerce in 95. And now you fast forward to 2009, 11, 12, 13, 14, where we are now. And there's still like a four or five-headed dragon. I mean, Gartner calls it taming the digital dragon. How do you deal with social, mobile, analytics, cloud, big data, bring your own device? I mean, incredibly difficult, and everything's being digitized, and as it becomes digitized, it becomes more democratic. And you know, the Gartner kind of thing that by 2016 CMOs will have more budget than CIOs, and makes the press, will it happen or not, doesn't make any difference. What it puts an emphasis on, though, is the people who are listening to this podcast, is they better get in front of what the customer needs are.
And it's interesting, as you point out, that history sort of repeats itself. The themes from 1987 are unfortunately still relevant today. You do know, as I do, a cadre of CIOs who are a cut above the rest. And I wonder, what are some of the factors you think cause them or lead them to be as successful as they have been? You know, as you diagnose those who have actually been able to rise above and be true drivers of value for the corporation, what makes them special?
To answer the question, I can really tie two things together. We're talking about in the book and also the successful CIO. What will make successful students and CIOs is the same thing. So it's not just being proficient in math and science if you're a student, or understanding the intricacies of the infrastructure and all this other stuff, hybrid, public, private, cloud, who cares, if you're a CIO. You have to get beyond that in terms of, some people pejoratively call them soft skills. They're not soft. They're hard, and they're hard to learn. It's how do you communicate? How do you collaborate? How do you work in cross-cultural environments? How do you lead? How do you inspire? These are the things that in these, top, you were at the Wall Street Journal conference a couple of weeks ago moderating a panel. You saw these people in the audience. I mean, they just stand out. They have a confidence level, but they know how to convey and communicate, understand and empathize and sell. I remember Rob Carter down at FedEx. I was talking to him a number of years ago, almost the same question you had asked. I was asking him. And he paused for a moment and he goes, "Gary, I always keep my selling shoes on." And that's the best way to answer that question, Peter. You know, the best CIOs, either they keep their best selling shoes or their best heels on in terms of every day at work, because they always got to be selling.
As you say, I think that is a underappreciated skill among the IT community, a community that's populated with people who are very analytical, but historically, at least on average, have not necessarily been the collaborators that they need to be.
And if we took the ones that you and I both know that are all-stars and did a Myers-Briggs on them, they basically all come out the same.
Well, Gary, last question for you. You know, as you look into your crystal ball out a few years, what are some IT trends that particularly excite you?
Excite and worry me at the same time, Peter, I guess is what I prefer to answer. I mean, exciting in terms of right now, we're just at the beginning of, there is talking about big data, but 95% of that data is unstructured. So we're just starting to mine that data field to find out nuggets that businesses will be able to use to produce better products, create happier customers, satisfied customers. So I think that's the thing that excites me most in terms of, you and I were talking about this earlier, sensors everywhere. I mean, data being collected is mind-boggling that there's a new term, in fact, for it called a yodobyte. And a yodobyte, for those who are curious, has 24 zeros after the first digit. A lot of data. So I think that's what excites me most. And the most successful CIOs in the world class, so you've seen these world class CIOs all the time, will be the ones who do the best job at gathering that data and mining it and serving the firms and customers with that data. The thing I worry about is the potential for the downside, too. I mean, we've seen this with malicious attacks on some of the retail stores over the last couple of months. And I worry about Internet of Things era, that every potential connection is also a potential backdoor to let some bad person in. And it's dual-edged sword there. So being an optimist, I'm more excited about the opportunities and also about the skills that people here in America and around the world to make it a safe place to do business and a safe place on the planet in terms of just global security. So I think data is the thing that excites me most.
That's great. Well, Gary Beach, thank you so much for taking time on the Forum on World Class IT today, sharing your perspectives and your really meaningful ideas about how to not only improve the role of the CIO and IT departments, but actually to improve the status of technology driven from America and building the leaders of tomorrow as well. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Peter, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat is a catalyst in communities of customers, contributors, and partners creating better technology the open source way. Connect to an ecosystem of innovation at redhat.com today to learn more. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.